أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Surah 9
At-Tawbah
Medinan period Title This surah has two titles
At-Tawbah
and Al-Bara'ah The former title owes its origin to the reference in the surah to God's pardoning of lapses committed by some believers See verse 117, and the latter title to the public dissolution of all treaty obligations with the polytheists mentioned in the opening verse of the surah. It is noteworthy that the usual opening formula, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah the Compassionate, the Merciful, is not prefixed to this surah. Commentators on the Quran have attributed a number of different reasons for this. Of these, the explanation given by
Fakhruddin al-Razi
seems to be the most plausible. As the Prophet, peace be upon him, did not direct his scribes to prefix the formula, his companions and successors also omitted it. Succeeding generations similarly adhered to the omission. This demonstrates how the Muslims painstakingly sought to receive the Quranic text from the Prophet, peace be upon him, exactly as it was revealed. And the care which they took to preserve it in its pristine form. Period of Revelation and Contents. This surah comprises three discourses. The first discourse runs from the opening verse to the fifth section of the surah. It was revealed in or around Zulqa'dah 9 after Hijri, 631 CE, soon after the Prophet, peace be upon him, dispatched Abu Bakr as the leader of the pilgrims to Mecca. After the verses had been revealed, the Prophet, peace be upon him, instructed Ali to follow Abu Bakr and to recite the same verses, proclaiming the new directives embodied in them before a representative gathering of Arabs who had gone there for pilgrimage. The second discourse covers sections 6 to 9 of the surah. It was revealed in or around Rajab 9 after Hijri, 631 CE, when the Prophet, peace be upon him, was busy making his preparations for an expedition to Tabuk. The discourse seeks to arouse the believers to wage jihad and reproaches severely those who, out of hypocrisy or infirmity of their faith, or out of sheer sloth and laziness, were reluctant to risk their lives and wealth in God's cause. Beginning with section 10, verse 73. The third discourse runs up to the end of the surah. Revealed upon the Prophet's return from the Tabuk expedition, it consists of several fragments which were revealed on different occasions during that period, and which under God's own instruction were arranged by the Prophet, peace be upon him, in the form of a coherent discourse. Since all these fragments center around a common subject and are related to the same set of events, any incongruity does not arise. The third discourse warns the hypocrites about their misdeeds and strongly censures those who, on the occasion of the expedition to Tabuk, had stayed behind. The verses also embody a combination of reproach and pardon for the believers who, even though they were sincere in their faith, had abstained from waging jihad in God's cause. Chronologically, the first discourse should have come at the end of the surah. However, in view of the significance of its contents, the Prophet, peace be upon him, in arranging the Quranic text, placed it at the beginning of the surah. Historical background. Having discussed the surah's period of revelation, let us now look at its historical setting. The contents of the surah are related to events arising from the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, 6 after Hijri, 628 CE. By the time this treaty was concluded, the struggle which had carried on for six long years had begun to bear fruit and Islam had emerged as the basis of an organized society, the inspiring force of a distinct cultural entity, and the guiding principle of a fully fledged sovereign state. The relatively peaceful atmosphere created by the Treaty of Hudaybiyah enabled Islam to propagate its teachings far and wide. The subsequent course of events followed two quite different directions, but led to dire consequences. One of these concerned Arabia, and the other the Byzantine Empire. A number of effective measures were taken by the Muslims after the conclusion of the treaty to propagate Islam and consolidate and reinforce Muslim power. The result was that within a period of 2 years, Islam had spread considerably and had become so immensely powerful that in comparison to Islam, the age-old Jahiliya of Arabia was reduced to an utterly ineffectual position. Eventually, when the more zealous members of the Quraysh found themselves on the verge of defeat, they lost all patience and broke the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. By so doing, they wanted to free themselves from the constraints of the treaty and prepare for a decisive encounter with Islam. The Prophet, peace be upon him, however, did not allow the Quraysh to seize the initiative. Launching a sudden attack on Makkah in Ramadan, 8 after Hijri, 629 CE, he was able to seize it. See Surah 8, note 43 above. Later, the ancient Jahiliyyah of Arabia resorted to desperate acts of belligerency. On the occasion of the Battle of Hunain, other tribes loyal to Jahiliyyah mustered their military forces together in a bid to prevent the spread of Islam's reformative revolution, which, after the capture of Mecca, had almost reached its zenith. Their efforts, however, came to naught, and their defeat made it abundantly evident that Arabia was destined to become and remain
Darul Islam.
Hardly 1 year had passed after the Battle of Hunain than the greater part of Arabia entered the fold of Islam. The power of Jahiliyyah lay shattered. Only a few opponents remained in the arena, and the ones that could still be found lay scattered across the peninsula, unable to wield any mentionable influence. Events which took place on the borders of the Byzantine Empire in the north contributed to this trend. The Prophet, peace be upon him, showed exceptional courage when he led a 30,000-strong force against the Byzantine army. By contrast, the Byzantine forces demonstrated timidity insofar as they chose to avoid armed conflict with the Muslims. As a result, both the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his faith were held in awe throughout Arabia. Upon the Prophet's return from Tabuk, delegation after delegation poured into Medina from every corner of the peninsula, embracing Islam and committing themselves to obey the Prophet, peace be upon him. This development has been portrayed in the Quran in the following words. When there comes to you help from Allah and victory, and you see people enter the religion of Allah in crowds,
An-Nasr
110:1-2. Conflict with the Byzantine Empire had begun even before the conquest of Mecca. After the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, the Prophet, peace be upon him, sent many delegations to different parts of Arabia, calling people to Islam. One such delegation went to the tribes inhabiting land close to the Syrian border in the north. These tribes were mainly Christians and were largely under the influence of the Byzantine Empire. They put 15 members of the delegation to the sword at a place called Zat al-Thala, or Zat Atla. Only the leader of the delegation, Ka'b ibn Umar al-Ghifari, managed to return home safely. Around the same period, the Prophet, peace be upon him, sent an envoy, Harith ibn Umar, to Shurahbil ibn Amr, the chief of Busra, in order to communicate to him the message of Islam. Shurahbil, who was both a tribal chief and a satrap of the Byzantine Empire, was responsible for the assassination of the Prophet's envoy, Harith. In these circumstances, the Prophet, peace be upon him, sent a 3,000-strong army of devotees towards the Syrian border in Jumad al-Awwal, 8 after Hijri, 629. This action was intended to secure the area for the Muslims and to deter the opponents of Islam from committing excesses against them, should they mistakenly consider that the Muslims lacked strength. When the army approached Ma'an, reports were received that Shurahbil was advancing towards them with a 100,000-strong army. Reports were also received that the Caesar of Rome was himself present at Hims, and that he had dispatched reinforcements to the tune of another 100,000 under the command of his younger brother, Theodore. Against all odds, the 3,000-strong Muslim contingent continued to advance and clashed with Shurahbil's army, 100,000 strong at Mota. The expected outcome of such an encounter was not hard to imagine: the total extermination of the Muslim force. What happened, however, was quite different. It came as a shock to the whole of Arabia and the Middle East, that the Romans failed to gain the upper hand, even though they outnumbered the Muslims by 33-1. It was this which aroused many people's initial interest in Islam. Ultimately, many thousands of people from the semi-independent Arab tribes living in Syria and its adjoining areas, from the Najdi tribes that inhabited the regions not far from Iraq and who were under the influence of Khosros, converted to Islam. People from the tribes of Sulaym, whose head was Abbas bin Mirdas al-Sulami, of Ashja, of Ghatfan, of Dubyan, of Fazara, also chose at this stage to embrace Islam. Farwa ibn Amr al-Judami, an Arab commander of the Byzantine army, also embraced Islam and inspired awe among the enemies of Islam by the fervor of his faith. When Caesar came to know that Farwa had embraced Islam, he had him arrested. He was given a clear choice between continued adherence to Islam, in which case he would be put to the sword, and renunciation of Islam, in which case he would continue to live and have his office restored to him. Calmly and confidently, he chose Islam, laying down his life for the sake of truth. Incidents such as these alerted Caesar to the gravity of the menace that was steadily advancing towards the Byzantine Empire. In an attempt to avenge himself for the Battle of Mota, Caesar ordered military preparations to commence on the Syrian border of the following year. Joining their forces with Caesar, the chiefs of the Ghassanid and other Arab tribes began to muster their troops. The Prophet, peace be upon him, was ever vigilant and kept himself abreast of all developments which had any bearing on his mission. He immediately understood the implications of Caesar's military preparations and promptly decided to challenge this mighty army on the battlefield. Any show of weakness on the part of the Muslims would have been disastrous. On the one hand, it might have given a fresh lease of life to the dying forces of Arabian Jahiliya, which had been dealt a crushing blow at Hunain. On the other hand, any demonstration of weakness might have encouraged the hypocrites to cause serious damage to Islam from within. For the hypocrites were in touch with the Ghazanid Christian prince and with Caesar himself through Abu Amir. Under the garb of religious piety, they actively worked to achieve their sinister purposes and had even built a mosque, the Mosque of Dirar, in the vicinity of Medina, which served as their operational base. Also, Caesar himself, whose morale was also high at the time for he had just then defeated the Persians, could have been prompted to mount an attack. If these three forces were to join hands and unitedly attack the Muslims, they could well turn the tables against them. The Muslims could lose what then seemed to be a winning battle. Alive to these facts and realizing the gravity of the situation, the Prophet, peace be upon him, publicly appealed to the Muslims to prepare for war against one of the two superpowers. He did so even though there prevailed near-famine conditions in Arabia. The scorching heat of the summer was at its peak, the harvest season had just about arrived, and there was a conspicuous shortage of material resources needed to wage a war. On similar previous occasions, the usual practice of the Prophet, peace be upon him, had been not to disclose such strategic information beforehand. For instance, the direction in which he would move and the enemy with whom he would engage. In fact, whenever he left Medina on a military expedition, it was his practice to conceal his intent by following an unusual route to the battlefield. On this occasion, however, he did not conceal his intent and declared that the Romans were his target and that he would advance towards Syria. The gravity of the situation was felt by everyone in Arabia. For the remaining devotees of Jahiliya, the encounter between Islam and the Byzantine Empire offered them a last ray of hope, and they looked forward to its outcome eagerly. The hypocrites also fully expected the Romans to strike a deadly blow against Islam. From their base, the Mosque of Dirar, they looked forward to the future eagerly, hoping that the outcome of the battle would afford them an opportunity to play their sinister game with impunity. Hence, they spared no effort in their attempts to undermine the Muslim military plans. Sincere Muslims also realized that the cause for which they had been striving for the last 22 years was at stake. They knew well that valiant action could open the door to Islam's ascendancy over the whole world. Conversely, any lapse on their part might seal Islam's fate even in Arabia. Moved by such thoughts, they responded fervently to the Prophet's call and commenced their war preparations, each Muslim contributing much more than his financial means warranted. Huge amounts of money were donated by Uthman bin Affan and Abdurrahman bin Auf. Umar contributed half of all his belongings, whereas Abu Bakr placed all that he possessed at the feet of the Prophet, peace be upon him. In the same spirit, companions with low incomes brought their hard-earned wages and donated them to the Prophet, peace be upon him. Women generously donated their jewelry to the war fund. Moved by the zeal to fight in God's cause, thousands of Muslims flocked to Medina from far and wide and expressed their readiness to sacrifice their lives. Those who could not be included in the Muslim army because of the acute paucity of cavalry and other war provisions wept bitterly and lamented their exclusion so pathetically that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was moved. The occasion, in fact, served as a touchstone for distinguishing the sincere from the insincere, the true men of faith from the hypocrites. The moment was so crucial for Islam that not going to the battlefront revealed the hollowness of a man's claim to believe in Islam. Accordingly, whenever the Prophet, peace be upon him, was informed during his journey to Tabuk that someone had decided to stay behind, he spontaneously said, "Let him alone. If there is any good in him, God will reunite him with you. And if it is otherwise, then thank God that he relieved you of him." In the month of Rajab, 9 after Hijri, the Prophet, peace be upon him, along with 30,000 soldiers, of whom only 1,000 were mounted, marched towards Syria. Camels were so few that the soldiers had to take turns to ride them. The blazing heat of the summer and the scarcity of water added to their hardship. On this occasion, the Muslims displayed a singular firmness of mind in enduring all hardships, for which they were amply rewarded upon their arrival at Tabuk. When the Muslims reached their destination, they learned that Caesar and his tributaries had moved their troops away from the borders and that there was consequently no enemy with whom they could fight. The writers of the Sida, works, biographies of the Prophet, mention that this incident in a manner which suggests that upon reaching Tabuk, it was found that the reports which the Prophet, peace be upon him, had received about the concentration of troops on the Syrian-Arabian border were false. The fact, however, is that Caesar had indeed begun amassing his troops on the border. He had to abandon the idea of an encounter and withdrew his army because the Prophet, peace be upon him, arrived ahead of the anticipated time and well before the planned concentration of troops had been completed. Caesar had not forgotten that the Muslims had given a very good account of themselves earlier on the battlefield at Mota and despite the overwhelming odds against them. Hence, Caesar did not dare confront the 30,000-strong army of Muslims, especially when it was led by the Prophet, peace be upon him, himself. He would probably have still been reluctant to engage in battle, even if he had mustered 100,000 or 200,000-strong army. The Prophet, peace be upon him, was satisfied with the advantages accruing from this moral victory. Instead of pushing on any further, he chose to derive maximum political and strategic advantage from the incident. He stayed in Tabuk for 20 days, and by exerting military pressure, was able to make several buffer states which had so far been under the hegemony of the Byzantine Empire, agree to become tributaries of the Islamic State, and so resign themselves to vassal status. In this connection, mention should be made of some notable chiefs. Uqaydir bin Abd al-Malik al-Kindi of Dumat al-Jandal, Yuhana bin Ruba of Ayla, and of the Christian chiefs of Makna, Jarba, and Adru, who agreed to pay the poll tax and accepted to live under the hegemony of Medina. The result was that the Islamic State now extended to the borders of the Byzantine Empire. In addition, a good number of Arab tribes whom successive Caesars had exploited against other Arabs crossed over to the Islamic side, offering their support to the Muslims as opposed to the Romans. This proved highly advantageous insofar as it enabled the Muslims to consolidate their position in Arabia before launching upon a prolonged conflict with the Romans. This bloodless victory at Tabuk shattered the power of both the unbelievers and the hypocrites who had looked forward to a revival of the ancient Jahiliyyah of Arabia. In sheer desperation, a great number of them saw that the only reasonable course left open to them was to enter the fold of Islam. Even though some of them lacked inner conviction, their entrance into the fold of Islam ensured the assimilation of their forthcoming generations to Islam. The few diehard unbelievers that remained loyal to polytheism and Jahiliyyah were so enfeebled that they no longer constituted a serious obstacle to the completion of the reformatory revolution for which God had raised His Messenger, peace be upon Him. Subject matter. If we bear this background in mind, it will help us appreciate more fully the major issues of the hour which the surah seeks to treat. 1. Since the believers had by then gained full control over Arabia and the forces against Islam lay crushed, it was necessary to proclaim the transformation of Arabia into a fully fledged Dar al-Islam. The following represent the salient features of that strategy. A. Polytheism and all its offshoots should be absolutely obliterated from Arabia in order to ensure that the land would always remain the exclusive base of Islam, a land where no extraneous ideologies would be allowed to impair the purity of Islamic belief and practice, nor any non-Islamic elements allowed to create subversion. It was for this reason that a proclamation of total disassociation from the unbelievers was made, and all agreements and treaties previously concluded with them were publicly annulled. B. Since the believers were now in control of the Kaaba, it was considered altogether inappropriate to allow polytheistic practices to continue in the shrine which was originally consecrated for the worship of the one true God. It was therefore proclaimed that the Kaaba should henceforth be placed under the exclusive charge of the believers, and all practices rooted in polytheism and Jahiliyyah should be forcibly extirpated from the precincts of the house of God. It was also proclaimed that the polytheists should no longer even be permitted to approach the Kaaba. This was done to rule out the possibility of any further sacrilege of God's house built by the prophet Abraham, peace be upon him. C. It was also considered highly inappropriate for any vestige of pre-Islamic polytheistic custom to be allowed to continue under the new Islamic dispensation. Attention was, therefore, drawn to their eradication. Of these, the hideous practice of nasi, the transposing of a prohibited month, was forthwith forbidden. This was to serve as an example for Muslims to do away with all vestiges of Jahiliyyah. 2. Once the objectives of the mission of Islam had been fulfilled within the peninsula, the next step was to spread the message outside Arabia. The Byzantine and Sassanid empires, the two mighty powers of the day, would be the major obstacles. A confrontation was therefore inevitable. Similar encounters with other non-Islamic political and social systems of the day would also be imminent at a later stage. In pursuit of their goal, the Muslims were directed, if necessary, by force, to put an end to all sovereign political entities which refused to submit to the truth, and to force non-Muslims to live under the suzerainty of Islam. Muslims were taught to recognize the right of non-Muslims either to embrace Islam or reject it. The Muslims did not, however, recognize that non-Muslims had the right to enforce the laws of their choice in opposition to the divine law of God on earth as it is created by God, and to thrust their errors and wrongdoings upon generation after generation by keeping the reins of power in their hands. At the most, they may be allowed to persist in their ignorance if they so wished. They could do so, however, only if they paid jizya, poll tax, and remained subservient to the Islamic State. 3. The third serious problem was presented by the hypocrites, who so far had been treated leniently. However, since pressure from hostile forces from without had considerably relaxed, in some instances ceased altogether, the Quran declared that henceforth no leniency ought to be shown them. These hidden enemies of Islam should be treated with the same severity as the open deniers of Islam. In line with this policy and during the preparations for the Tabuk expedition, the Prophet, peace be upon him, arranged for Suwaylim's house where a group of hypocrites had assembled to discuss their plans for dissuading the Muslims from joining the expedition to Tabuk to be set ablaze. Again, it was in keeping with the same policy that as soon as the Prophet, peace be upon him, returned from Tabuk, he demolished and set ablaze Masjid Dirar. 4. It also seemed necessary to strengthen the faith of the true believers in order that any weakness in their determination might be eradicated. This was essential as the mission of Islam was about to enter its universal phase in which one single entity, Muslim Arabia, would be arrayed against the entire non-Muslim world. At such a stage in its development, there could be no greater menace to Islam than the weakness of the faith of its followers. Accordingly, anyone who on the eve of the Tabuk expedition had either neglected or slackened off in his duty was severely reproached. Any lagging behind without legitimate cause was considered beyond any doubt evidence of hypocrisy, a sign of not having true faith. It was stated, therefore, unequivocally, that participation in the struggle to exalt the word of Allah and in the conflict between Islam and unbelief would henceforth be considered the basic criterion of a person's faith. Whoever was found to be slack in his efforts to sacrifice his life, wealth, and resources in Islam's cause would no longer be regarded as genuine, and none of his acts, no matter how pious he might otherwise be, would compensate for this slackness.